This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, and mobile web development. Build and Analyze is hosted by Marco Arment. He's the co-founder of Tumblr.com and the creator of Instapaper.com, and by Dan Benjamin, that's me. And this episode is brought to you by Sensible World, a small Vermont design studio specializing in branding, symbols, websites, and wayfinding. Sensible World's founder, Jory Raphael, has created Symbolicons, a stylish and unique family of royalty-free vector icons and symbols for use on websites, iPhone apps, and more. As a special offer, just for Build and Analyze listeners, all Symbolicon sets are $10 off through the end of the year. You can check them out at sensibleworld.net/5x5. And I should also mention, they did all of the 5x5 cover art and show artwork. So if you like it, go hire this man. Hey, Marco.
How you doing, Dan?
Doing well. We are finally back for episode number 2. What a great room. I'm humbled and shocked by the response that we've gotten for this show, in no small part due to you, I think, sharing your insight and ideas here. It's so cool to be doing a show with you. I'm so psyched about it.
Thanks. No, I mean, and you know, without you know, I love people talk about how much they like each other. Without all of your efforts, you know, this would all be invisible and not produced. So. And plus, I can't be a host of something.
Sure you can. You are a host.
Being a host, it requires a lot of really specific kinds of talent that most people don't have. And you have it, and that's why it works. I really don't have those talents.
I disagree, and I think if you were to listen to episode number 1, you'd see that you did most of this smart talking.
Well, but the host's role is mostly to guide the show, to move it along when it's getting a little bit long in one part. And you know, to know what questions to ask, and to basically not let there be any dead time. And I really could never do that. And you do that very well.
Thank you very much. But no, we're both incredibly surprised and humbled. We hit number 1 in technology.
That was amazing.
First episode. So, yeah. So in any case, thank you guys for that. Thanks for the ratings. And if you like the show and you want to rate it, it really does help us get an audience, which is what we're hoping to do. So this week we promised, because we didn't get to it last week, we promised that we wanted to talk about the Apple App Store, which is the new big deal for getting your apps that you write for Mac OS X out the same way that people are getting iOS apps. So that's not all we'll talk about, of course, but that's one of the big topics, right?
Sure, and I'm sure it's not going to be the only time when we talk about this.
Right. Well, yeah. But
the big news is that, you know, that they're doing, that they're, you know, they're having the Mac App Store, and you know, a lot has already been said about this and written about it. So I don't want to go too far in depth with this episode because there's really not any new information recently on it. But it's interesting, you know, watching or talking to Mac developers and watching some of them react to this as they're developing their Mac apps, as they're getting them ready for the App Store. They have to remove any private API usage. And a lot of them are finding that, you know, they thought off the top of their head when this first launched, I don't use any major private APIs. That shouldn't be a problem.
Right.
And they're finding that in a lot of cases, you know, there is some strange interface limitation or actually a bug that they're working around, that they use a private API in some really minor situation somewhere. But removing it would be a real pain, and so they're actually finding that it's a little more complex than they thought.
Yeah, and that's got to be a surprise to a lot of people, a big surprise, because they think, oh well, I'm just doing something basic. Everybody does this, and the reality of it is that they're breaking guidelines, and there's no penalty. There's no penalty to doing that until you realize, oh man, this is going to make it so I can't distribute this app this new way.
Right. Like, I think it's easier to avoid the private APIs on iOS because the platform is much younger, so all of our software is much younger for it, and it's always been forbidden. And, you know, during the first, I think, year and a half or so of the App Store, you could actually use private APIs as long as the reviewer wouldn't notice. So, you know, you couldn't do things that really should not have been able to be done. Right. Like some of the direct camera access and things like that at the time, you couldn't do those publicly. But like I use a number of private APIs in Instapaper in the first few versions because there were a lot of limitations to what UI Web View could do and what the scroll view inside of it could, how it could be accessed and everything. So I used a few private APIs to do really, really minor things like change the scroll indicator from black to the light gray in dark mode, because that's not a public API. Now you can kind of hack it, but at the time that was all private. So I just shipped it, and you know, I did it
under the radar, and that's how it got out, or
Oh no, yeah, and it was fine, you know, because what the reviewers were looking for. What was basically anything really obvious that you shouldn't have been able to do. Like I said, like camera sensing stuff, like back before that was an API. And, you know, like if you wanted to use the proximity sensor before that was an API, stuff like that. But if you were doing something that was really very subtle, they probably wouldn't notice or wouldn't care about if they actually did notice, or they wouldn't even know that was a private API, then you could generally get away with it. But then, probably, 6 months ago or so, they started actually running a static analyzer against the binaries you submit. And I assume it hooks into the runtime, and it actually basically keeps track of all the selectors that you perform and all the instance variables that you access in system libraries. And it basically has a list of what it knows is public and what isn't. And if you call anything that's not public during the test cycle, they'll reject the app for that. And so now, like, you really can't get away with it. And I assume they're going to do the exact same thing when testing Mac apps for review.
But don't you think it'll be even more difficult to test Mac apps because of the... I mean, I haven't done a whole lot of Mac OS X development in the last, I'll say, year. But there's so many... API calls there's so many things, and it's not to downplay the complexity of an iOS app, because there's tons of amazing things you can do on the iOS side, but isn't the API smaller and more compact in some ways in iOS than it is for OS X? Isn't it going to be harder for them to actually check and figure that out?
It is a lot smaller, you're right, but on iOS it's much, much smaller, but they're doing it automatically. Like they have this tool that that will allow them to basically automatically detect whenever anything that's marked as private or not allowed, whenever that's called by an app. So all they have to do to find it, I don't actually know if it scans through the binary to see all the references it makes. I don't know if that would be reasonably possible, because you can build up a selector with a string, I think, but. It watches during runtime to see what it calls. So right. All they have to do is cause it to call that private API during their testing. Now, apps can be very complex. There can be like a lot of situations or screens that Apple's testers won't get to during testing. I do know that like for my apps, so that I have Instapaper, and I have Instapaper Free. And Free has a lot fewer features. And Free is always approved much faster than the paid version. And the impression I get is that there's actually different treatment for apps that are very complex. They actually put them either in a different queue, or they assign them to different people, or have different procedures in place where different apps will actually be tested for a lot longer, maybe, you know, 20 minutes instead of 6 minutes or something like that. But they are tested for much, much longer than apps with fewer features.
So just to be clear, a human being... or perhaps a series of human beings are testing an app, as opposed to it's not some kind of automated thing that looks at the compiled code or looks for a certain API call. This is a human being who's knowledgeable enough about API calls, actually by hand looking at and running every single one of these apps.
No, it is a human being running the app, but they're running it in a testing environment that has a specially modified runtime, I assume. That basically the environment they're running it in as they're testing it will alert them if a private API is called.
And they have the ability, I guess, though, to decide or make a judgment call as far as whether that API call is something they're going to allow, or is it a hard rule where they say, oh, no, you made an API call, we don't allow, reject
it. It's a hard rule. Yeah, it's a hard rule. They and again before they had the special runtime or whatever this tool is that does this automatically for them. Before they had that, it was an issue of if they would notice, and if they wouldn't notice, you could get through no problem. But now it's a hard rule, and they will notice every single time. Hmm. I did find that when I was trying to before OS 4.0, there was no good way, and 3.2, there was no good way to detect when the user tapped the status bar to make it scroll to the top. And because in my app, I actually offer an undo for that, because that's a surprising and destructive action that a lot of people don't intend when they do it. So they basically what I had was this huge, you know, private poking thing. I would poke the GS event object and try to figure out some of its variables. And as long as I didn't call any selectors on it, I'd be fine. So I could access its instance variables in this really horrible hacky way. And as long as I didn't call a method on it, then I'd be able to get through. But fortunately, I don't need that hack anymore either, because now you can just do that in the API.
So that seems to be the case, though, is that at first they weren't checking as closely for the private API calls. Then they started to check much, much more diligently for them. And at the same time, maybe they've relaxed what's private or what you're allowed to do in the process. So there's a little bit of give and take, no?
Well, it's some of it, yeah. I mean, it depends on what you're doing. So every new OS release includes new APIs. And a lot of those were APIs that had already existed in earlier OSs. They just either they weren't public or they were very different, and so they wanted to keep them private until they were stabilized. Apple tends to really stand by their APIs, so they're very conservative in what they make a public API. Because once it's public, they want to leave it there, if possible, forever. Effectively forever. So they're very, very conservative in what they make public. And that's one of the reasons why they're so adamant against private API use, because as long as it's private, they want the ability to change it without breaking people's apps.
Do you think then that as we see more and more features added with the new generation of iOS apps, and of course we're talking a bit more about macOS 10, do you think as this evolves that they'll be more conservative, they'll keep it the way it is, or that eventually they'll just start to open these things up? Let me also ask you this, what's the reasoning behind keeping, I mean, obviously there's a reason why they want to do things on iOS side with keeping the camera, access to that initially, keeping that as a private API, but on macOS 10, why keep things private? Why make them private? Why not just say, well, it's macOS 10, it's, you know, explain that. What's the thinking behind there?
So from what I can tell, and again, this is mostly speculation and conjecture based on limited interactions and hints here and there from, you know, anything I can get out of Apple people. But Apple is a very small company in development for, you know, relative to the number of products they have. They don't have tremendous engineering teams that are working on every single little thing. So they have limited focus resources that they can use. And so they tend to develop new frameworks fairly conservatively and make them really, really good also. But as I said, you know, a minute ago, like before something is public, they want the ability to change it and to really make sure they want to keep supporting it for a long time, because once they make it public, they want to support it forever.
Right.
So the reason why they make things private usually is because they're unfinished, or they aren't really that confident that they're going to keep them with the current functionality or the current interfaces. So, but the different issue is why they forbid you if you figure out how to use that, even if you can use it well. Like when I was using private calls in Instapaper, I would check for them to exist with can respond to selector and things like that. I would really be very conservative in calling them to make it very unlikely that the app would ever crash as a result. You know, if for whatever reason I couldn't find that selector there, I just wouldn't use that functionality. But a lot of people don't do that. And what we have to consider here is developers who will do it right are the minority. Because when you look at the App Store, there's so many developers there who who either don't care or don't know how to do something like that conservatively. So when Apple is reviewing the apps, if an app crashes because it called an API incorrectly, then that's more work for the app review team, because now they have to reject that app. They have to, you know, take a note to say why it crashed, where it crashed, and then that's going to result in another submission from that user when they fix it and resubmit it. So a lot of Apple's policies with the App Store and with what's allowed are very obviously targeted at just reducing unnecessary app review cycles. So, like, for example, I think there have been very few times during the course of the App Store where the average return rate, the average review time was less than 7 days. It's almost always been around 7 days. And I think one of the reasons for that is that you can't update your app more often than every 7 days then. Because while a lot of people won't, conscientious developers probably won't issue updates every week, but there are developers in the App Store who would gladly issue an update every single day that changes almost nothing just to get themselves on the top of the new charts and everything else.
Right.
And just to keep some kind of buzz with their users. I don't know. So all the policies that Apple has, we have to look at it from the point of view of what are all of those developers going to do, not what the old Mac developers are going to do.
Right.
And so with private APIs, it's really, all those developers would use them and cause problems and crashes for the app review team. And then the app review team would have more work. And that's the last thing they need, because they're already overworked. So then it's just a matter of Apple saying, all right, now we have this automatic tool that will always block that, which will not only make it easier for the app review team, it'll speed up the reviews when they are misusing it, and it'll really strongly discourage them from ever misusing it again, because now they know that we can catch them automatically.
That's really fascinating. And how do you know this? I mean, this is from talking to people at Apple or your secret sources?
Honestly, most of it's just observation and guessing.
Really?
Apple is a brick wall to talk to directly. But if you just kind of observe the actions that and the results that come out of that company, you can kind of take pretty good guesses. And being able to predict Apple's motivations or what they're doing and what they're going to do is really just a matter of watching the company for a while and figuring out how they do things and kind of watching what leaks out effectively and making educated guesses based on how they perform.
So have you been talking to a lot of people who are submitting regular, I should say, Mac OS X apps to the App Store and getting rejected? Have you been hearing a lot of stories about that?
I haven't heard of any rejections yet. I don't even know. That'd be a great question if anyone else knows.
Yeah.
I haven't heard of any rejections or acceptances from the Mac App Store yet. I don't even know if they're doing that yet. I know they're accepting submissions, but I don't know if they're doing anything with them.
Yeah, I think it'll be really cool and interesting to hear both about the successful acceptance and the rejection stories. I mean, I think it's much more obvious to people why something would be rejected on the Mac OS X side, and it seems like you hope they would be a little bit less nitpicky. I mean, we've all heard the stories and this is something that's sort of well known about rejections that seem weird on the iOS side of the house, like, oh, there was a caricature and then they rejected it, things like that, as opposed to technical reasons. But on the OS X side, it almost seems like the door is wide open for why they will reject things. Do you think that the initial criteria, though, that Apple has set up on the OS X side is open-minded enough, or do you think it's initially too restrictive the way things seemed really restrictive on the iOS side?
Well, I think it's the same. I think it's almost as though they copied and pasted the entire iPhone App Store and just pasted it onto the Mac. It's going to be almost identical from the beginning, I think.
Really?
But I don't think it's necessarily that bad of a thing. The iOS App Store today is in pretty good shape, really. There's really very few problems with it. There are some, of course, but I think there are also problems with the alternative. If you look at like the Android store, where there's effectively no regulation at all, no
right.
filtering,
right.
That has its own set of problems as well. And I think that the iOS store is in a state where it has fewer problems than the Android store overall for both users and developers. And so I think Apple is doing it as well as they can do it on iOS. And I think bringing that to the Mac, you know, there's a lot of value in that app review process and in that strictness. Like,
right.
for example, you know, my computer, I have a lot of really important data on here. I have sensitive data, I have valuable data, and I just have important personal data. And if I download an app, it has read-write access to everything, at least in my home directory, if I run something natively. And that kind of scares me. So I won't take very many risks with what I download. I use very little software, actually, and which is odd, given that I'm a computer geek and that I make software. But yeah, I'm very conservative with what I use. And with the App Store, I can be a little more reassured that whatever I'm downloading is not going to do something really crazy with my address book or you know, my home directory or anything like that. Because I know that somebody at Apple has tested it and it didn't explode, and you know, it wasn't malware. Now, you can't be 100% sure that these apps will never do that, because it could just be that the testers didn't notice, or that it's like a timed payload that's not going to activate till after testing.
Right.
So you can't be 100% sure, but it's still an extra level of reassurance that, okay, someone else has run this. I'm not the only person on earth with this app, and that someone has kind of vetted it, saying, okay, it works, it doesn't steal your crap, and it, you know, doesn't crash. That's another thing too. If I'm going to pay for an app, and presumably there's not going to be any trials, just like the App Store, for the time being, which that's actually a pretty big limitation. But assuming that I'm going to be paying for these apps, I also want to know that okay, they're going to work on Snow Leopard, which like when 10.7 comes out, right after 10.7 comes out, or rather right after I start using it, I'm going to want to know with every app I buy, does this actually work on 10.7, or
yeah.
have they not gotten to that yet?
Right.
You know, and like every new release, that's always an issue with software. And I just think that having the App Store as the intermediary will make a lot of those things a lot better.
It seems totally worth it to me to know that this app that I'm about to download has been vetted. It's not just going to instantly crash. It's not going to do something nefarious as far as Apple knows.
Right.
And there's that kind of assurance. Yeah. To buy it and say, I'm not wasting my money. And look, here's all these reviews of it.
Exactly. And then and also, when you buy it, you only have to type in your password. That's it. There's no credit card, billing information. You don't really have to worry. Like, if it's some company that you're pretty sure is going to send you one of those spam email newsletters every
yeah.
single week announcing
yeah.
nothing, you know, you don't have to worry about that anymore, because they won't even get your information. you know, they won't know your billing address. They won't know anything like that. And also, you never have to remember the serial number for this program. You don't have to keep it in a safe place. You don't have to worry, what if I ever lose it? You know, there's nothing like that. And presumably, I actually don't know. I don't know how this is going to work yet. How do you think multiple computer installation is going to be handled?
You know, that's a good question. The licensing thing is a huge question when it comes to the App Store. And that's the one that of the people that I know who have or are building apps and are thinking to themselves, wow, the App Store, I totally want my app in there. There is that big question sitting there, which is, how are they going to handle licensing? How are they going to handle multiple computer installations? When a lot of the software that's out there right now, their license agreement says you can install it on as many computers as you like, but you can only use it on one of them at a time. And that's fairly typical in the Mac OS X world. And I know that, you know, for example, a handful of the apps that I've downloaded on the iOS side, I'll have them on my iPhone, which, although it's not active on AT&T, I still have an iPhone. And I'll also have it on the iPad. And my understanding is that's there's no problem with that. Maybe I'm wrong. And iTunes has no problem installing it on any iOS device that I seem to plug in that's registered to me. So How will they do that? How do you think they'll do that on the OS X side? That's a great question.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea. I suspect that because so the way it works on iOS is you can have it up to a pretty high number of devices. I think it's 10. It's a lot of devices as long as they all use the same iTunes account.
Right.
And you know, as long as they're logged into the same iTunes account. And on the computer, you know, on the Mac, I guess maybe the App Store app itself will have the concept of the currently logged in iTunes account, or it will just use iTunes, but I hope not. I think iTunes doesn't need anything more added to it.
Yeah. And Maurice Kelly in the chat room says, right now I have multiple, you know, and this is, I'm just trying to reword his question here. Software right now allows multiple users to use software on his Mac, but after the Mac App Store, will my wife have to download her own copy of the software because she has a separate iTunes account? Will the separate accounts complicate things? What if, you know, what if you and I share a computer and you log in and then I log in? How are we going to do that? Not forget separate computers. What about the same computer?
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah, the multiple user accounts on one computer. Yeah, because they will have different iTunes accounts. That's, yeah, I mean, there's so much unknown and seemingly unspecified in the public right now.
Yeah.
It's going to be really interesting during the first few weeks of the availability of the Mac App Store once everyone is figuring this stuff out and seeing it and trying it. Because, that's a great question. I would have assumed iTunes accounts were... Now, see, I wonder if it will use home sharing. Like, does the iTunes home sharing feature... I don't think it has a way right now to cross different user accounts on the same Mac, but I don't know if it necessarily needs to right now. But I think home sharing is probably going to be used in some capacity to address these concerns.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating response because that seems like so far the best technique to do this kind of sharing, but with home sharing, it's just one file, you know, or maybe if it's an iTunes enhanced movie or something, it's a couple of files. But even then, you've got to essentially move them by hand with an application that needs to be installed and preferences and other things. You know, I mean, I doubt that they're going to bring all that around. And, you know, even with a simple app, like say, well, you know, BBEdit is a great example. There's a whole lot of preferences in BBEdit that you can configure. Right. Now, if I buy a license of BBEdit and I have my, you know, my MacBook, which I'm going to take with me when I want to, you know, when I travel or when I go to a coffee shop or whatever, and my Mac Pro, I would love it if I could sync those preferences. But I know that even if I can share that app between computers, assuming that Apple lets you do that, it's not going to take all my preferences. So I'm still going to have to manage those independently, even if the licensing and that sharing capability works. But I just get the feeling that the App Store is targeted more at people who just have one computer. I really wonder, and I think music is an exception to that. They've always had, iTunes has always had a problem, I think, with getting music onto multiple computers and licensing multiple computers to use that music and play it, and the number of devices that you can have that are authorized and authorizing on all of the devices and realizing that you've authorized too many devices and you've got to delete them all and start from scratch. I mean, it seems to me like the headache, what would prevent you from using home sharing or something else to get that software installed on multiple Macs? And once it's on there, you know, you don't really have iTunes making sure that the DRM works. I mean, once it's installed over there, it's installed there. And that's a problem that we have, you know, that regular applications have right now. If you just download it, you can install it in as many places as you want. And if you have that registration code and the computer's not internet connected, then you can probably maybe do the wrong thing and install it anywhere. How do you think Apple will respond to that? Are they going to try and control that? This is the kind of thing that surprises me that they're doing the App Store at all because of all these issues. It's so complicated. It seems so much more straightforward with an iOS device.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, think about if you want to uninstall an app that you bought from the App Store. does it delete all the various little preferences files that it put all over your library directory?
Yeah.
Like, and like, what if it puts them somewhere else? And like, you know, on iOS, there's no concept of any kind of
storage,
shared documents directory,
yeah,
or, you know, shared files. So, well, I guess now there might be, but you know, for the most part, there isn't. And so, like, if you delete a note taking app, all your notes get deleted with it. If you delete a note taking app from the Mac App Store that's on your Mac, what happens to the documents it created? And is its preference file kept for like, if you want to install it again later on, is the preferences file kept so you have all your preferences back? Or is it like iOS where you have to start clean every time? Which is actually kind of a feature, in my opinion. Like, one thing, you know, the Fraser Spears pointed out a while back on one of your shows that one of the great things about the Mac App Store or about the iOS App Store is that it's easy to try out apps because you know that you can just delete them and they're fully deleted. Everything about them gets deleted when you delete that
app.
And on the Mac, that probably isn't going to work that way because there's so much legacy convention built in that really isn't very compatible with that.
That's a great point too, in that the removal of apps, there are actually apps out there right now that their entire purpose is just to help you cleanly remove an app from a Mac OS machine. And
if you've ever bought a software bundle from anywhere on the Mac, you probably have 15 licenses for AppZapper.
Yeah. And it's a great utility. It cleans out all of those files. It finds them. Does the App Store, do you think it'll do that? Will it do that?
I have no idea. I'm guessing not, because there's just so much compatibility, you know, and convention that we have on the Mac now. You know, we know that preferences files are stored in you know, library preferences in a plist, and when an app is deleted, normally the preference is not deleted. So that way, if you ever install it again in the future, you have all your preferences still set the same way.
That could be considered a great feature for some people too.
Right. Yeah. So you can really go either way on that one. There's the application support directory, which stores all of its data and temp files and things like that, supposedly.
Right.
You know, there's issues with that. And then what if the app puts files somewhere else? You know, like,
yeah, that's
Apple
what you
says,
mentioned before. Is
it,
there's nothing right now to, you know, a well-behaved app is going to store all of its supportive files in the home library application support folder and within that a folder that's named after the app. That is the way that Apple says you should do this.
Right.
But like you mentioned, there's nothing to enforce that. You know, if a misbehaved app could store it at the root of your hard drive, you know, it can put it anywhere it wants. And there are
/temp.
Yeah. And there are a handful of apps that still to this day that still do that and do things incorrectly. And when people notice, they generally, you know, if it's really bad, they will comment about it. I know that the one that occurs to me most recently is that Valve Software, makers of games like Half-Life, they store, you know, you have to use Steam to download. And people asked on one of the other shows where I was talking about the App Store why we didn't talk about Steam. So I wanted to mention that here too.
Sure, yeah.
But Steam will put its downloaded files and full-on games and things like that in places that you wouldn't necessarily want it to. And that would be in your home folder when maybe you don't want all of the games that you've downloaded in your home folder. Maybe you want them in applications or something. So,
hey, didn't it put it in the documents directory?
Yeah,
at first,
I think it.
It was like a very Windowsy thing, because Windows has the My Documents folder,
right?
And then everything is a subfolder of that. So My
That's
Documents
what it was,
is basically
yeah.
your home folder on Windows,
right?
Not really about documents necessarily. And then within My Documents is my music, my pictures, all that other stuff.
Yeah, and it, you know, I think it's the same thing with is it VMware Fusion or other ones that will put like all of the virtual machine drives in your documents folder by default.
That's a fun one when you're on a laptop with a small hard drive and you can't figure out where the heck your space went.
Right.
And discover these like 16 gig folders buried 19 levels deep.
Right. So there's no, you know, and there's nothing to enforce that. Will that be one of the things you think that the App Store could or should enforce, is that you need to follow our guidelines now and only put these kinds of things in the folders that we say?
I think they should, certainly.
Yeah.
But I don't know if they could yet. So, because, you know, again, right now, a lot of these conventions are just missing. Like, where do you store your documents files? I think a lot of apps might disagree on where they should store documents that are created with those apps.
Right.
Is it just in your home folder, just loose in, you know, at the top level of your home folder? So there's issues there, certainly. You know, like, cause like, what if the app is saving something that's not necessarily conceptually a document? Like what, you know, what would you call this thing this app is saving? You know, so there are a lot of missing conventions there that there just isn't a standard for. And maybe in 10.7, we know almost nothing about 10.7 really. We know what a few of the interface features are going to look like, but that's about it. And even that can change. So maybe 10.7 has more defined concepts for some of these things. Like maybe the apps are more sandboxed from each other, and maybe it requires special permission or a special type of approval for an app to be able to read outside of its own little sandbox directory. Who knows? These are all giant unknowns, which is why it's kind of odd that the Mac App Store is being released effectively now.
Yeah.
Before we know any of this stuff.
Do you expect, though, Marco, do you expect it that was it good? One of the initial things that we heard was, you know, people saying, oh, for example, a Photoshop, you know, the all of the Adobe suites, and maybe Adobe's a bad example because of the stuff that's going on in the world of Flash, but let's say, you know, Microsoft
Flash
Office.
Memory?
Yeah.
We love Flash memory.
Let's say Microsoft Office, you know, or something like that, one of these big third-party app suites. People were saying initially, oh, those will never be in the App Store, but what if they are? Do you think we can anticipate any kind of big announcements like that? Do you think that bigger players will want to get through that channel?
I don't at all, because number one, any player that big is never going to agree to the 30% cut.
Yeah.
But the bigger problem is simply that they're all going to be using private APIs for something. You know, something like Photoshop or Office. These are massive software products that have huge histories, weird backwards compatibility issues. You know, all this stuff they have to deal with. These massive runtimes to have consistent interfaces on multiple platforms, all these things. There's no way they can do all that without private APIs. Or rather, technically, I'm sure they could, but it's very unlikely that they did.
Yeah.
And so it's never going to be worth it for them to go through and try to remove all that and try to comply with whatever Apple's standards become if they change in the future.
You don't think, and some people have suggested this, I don't think so, but do you think that this App Store will result in any way in the homogenization of the way that apps look, and that we'll start to see a lot more apps with just a single function as opposed to bigger, more robust applications?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, let me be clear. The Mac App Store, especially at the very beginning, is going to be a place to make a lot of money, right? If you have an app there on day one, you will make a lot of money because there aren't going to be that many apps, but there's going to be a lot of people looking at the apps. If I had an idea for a reasonable Mac app, believe me, I would have already made one and submitted it, but I don't, because it's going to be a mini Goldberg. So it's going to be similar to what happened when the iPad launched, except that there's a lot more Macs. Now, there's not, you know, it's not as hot of a product. You know, the Mac, people care a lot less about the Mac every day than they cared about the iPad when it launched. But there's still going to be a lot of people looking at that store, looking to browse around and buy things and try it out. And there's not going to be very many apps on day one. So if you're there, you'll make a lot of money. I guarantee it. Well, don't hold me to that.
So why?
It's very likely.
Why then don't you, aren't you sitting there right now saying, I've got to do an app. I've got to have an app just to put it out there.
I have no good ideas for a Mac app. You know, for the moment, I don't think an Instapaper Mac app really makes a lot of sense. We'll see. The 11-inch Air might change that if it's a huge hit, but I just don't think it makes a lot of sense for Instapaper. And then so the question becomes, okay, what else might I make? And I don't know. Do you have any? What should I make, Dan? What ideas do you have?
Well, I mean, if I had one, I'd be doing it too.
Right, exactly. And that's kind of the problem. With desktop software, this is one of the reasons why if you're in the Mac App Store on day one, you'll probably be very successful, because there's not going to be very many apps. Because desktop software, really, you don't need that much of it. You know, what we've kind of trained ourselves to do, you know, as a geek society over the last decade or so, is to actually stop using software as much as possible and move to web and cloud-based apps. I hate the word cloud. But you know, move to web apps more, and minimize local software, and because there's so many benefits to that. And, you know, there's some limitations and costs as well. But for the most part, I think most people don't use that much software on their computers.
No, they really don't. It's fascinating, and that's something that has always been fascinating to me, is that the people that I know, that especially those of us like you who create software, you have this vision, even if you're one of these people, almost, that, you know, geeks have tons and tons of software and tons of stuff running and things that, but in reality, it seems like geeks are trending toward minimalism. I try and install as few apps as possible. I try to customize the user interface as little as possible. I try to run with as stock of a system, you know, as I can. I change the background to gray.
Me too.
You know, I install, you know, the other, I'm not talking necessarily about the machine that I use to produce these shows, but on a regular machine that I'm using, you know, I've got like an editor and, you know, like Skype and Chrome. And I mean, it's really, really minimal. And right, I try to keep
there's
it
lots
though.
Of advantages to that.
Yeah, I mean, the development environment that I have to do if I'm doing Rails apps, these days there really isn't even that much to install.
Yeah, so much of it is just built into the system.
Yeah. I mean, you download, if you're building Mac apps, you know, you need Xcode, but there's very little that you need besides that. And I think it's just interesting that the timing of the App Store, that the time that they decided to launch this and release it, is also interesting. And I've heard a lot of speculation as to why now. Why do you think it's coming now?
I think it's because strategically it makes a lot of sense for them to have this and as soon as possible. Because, you know, first of all, its existence is going to mean that a lot of iOS developers who are many iOS developers are new to Mac. They came to the Mac because they needed to buy a Mac to develop for iOS. And so it's a lot of it is to try to get them to make Mac software.
Yeah.
Because that will then strengthen the Mac platform and, you know, strengthen Apple's advantages over Windows and bring more people to the Mac. So that's a big part of it. And a lot of people say, oh, Apple wants their 30% cut of everything they can get their hands on. The fact is, I don't think Apple's making that much of a killing with that 30%. They are. I mean, they're making a lot of money, but relative to them, it's like a drop in the bucket. They probably really don't care that much about the 30% because it costs them a lot of money to run the whole App Store. You know, think of the massive app review team that they have to process all these submissions and stuff. So, like, they have all those costs. They have dealing with all the credit cards and they have to deal with. I mean, think of if you ever looked at a support inbox, you know, you know how much support email gets generated from a relatively small amount of users.
Yeah.
Imagine what they get for all the App Store purchases when people email them saying, I didn't really like this app after all. I want a refund. All, you know, so they incur a lot of cost to run this. So I'm sure it is profitable. You know, I'm sure 30% covers it plus some, but it's probably not that big of a profit center for them. And so I don't think that's the reason. I think it's really strategic. It's about getting a lot of developers to write Mac software who were otherwise just writing iOS software, and solving a big problem on the Mac, which is that there was really no good place to go and browse for Mac software. That was very, you know, mass market and friendly. And it's also going to bring, as we said earlier, it's going to bring some of the benefits of having app review to the user. It's going to bring those benefits to the Mac as well. So I think that's why they're doing it. Now, you know, who knows why they're doing it now in particular, but I think all those like kind of big picture benefits would apply no matter when they did it. So I think they just did it as soon as they were ready to do it.
Mm. That's
interesting. And I think all the little technical and implementation details, I think they kind of just said, all right, well, we'll figure those out as we go.
There is definitely going to be a lot of figuring out as they go, though, for them and I think for the developers too.
Absolutely.
It's just, it's such a mysterious kind of situation because people are submitting these apps and I don't think there's really very much coming out of Apple right now as far as what, besides this initial set of guidelines, there aren't any. And there are people, like I was talking to Dave Nanian, he's the guy that does Super Duper, the backup app for Macs. And
love it.
I use that thing too. And he was saying, you know, he's not even going to bother submitting Super Duper because it falls so far outside of the kind of app that belongs in the store. And of course, it does need essentially root access and other things that would disqualify it immediately. But he, you know, when I asked him about it, he said, you know, I'm not even really that concerned with how the App Store will affect Super Duper sales. And that's because something like that, you need to get outside of the App Store. There's just no way to get it from within the App Store itself. I mean, it just doesn't fit in that space whatsoever. But you've got to think that companies right now that are building applications that maybe are using those private APIs, they've got to be concerned that there's some new up-and-coming developer who's going to make something that's like what they're doing but simpler, that doesn't use those private APIs, and it's going to be in the App Store on day one. And because of that limitation, and maybe because they couldn't get their app ready in time or it was rejected or something else, that they're going to get their... you know, basically somebody else is going to eat their lunch.
I mean, that's probably going to happen in a few cases, no question. But there's going to be a lot of app categories, like backup apps, where the nature of the app makes it such that it will probably never be approved. Like, it'll probably never qualify for the App Store because it needs root access and because it, you know, might use private APIs, right, and things like that. So there's going to be a whole category of apps that won't really be able to be represented at all in the App Store. And that's fine. You know, it's the App Store, it's going to be like Walmart opening up. You know, it's going to be a really high profile, big retailer in this. Now, okay, so I'm going to make a strip mall analogy because I'm from the Midwest and they have lots of strip malls. I heard a rumor that the first strip mall is actually the place I took my driver's test in Columbus, Ohio. But so anyway, I don't know if that's true. That's probably just something Ohio people say. But it's like if a Walmart opens up in a strip mall and next door to it is a Radio Shack. And I'm talking about the old Radio Shack where they used to actually sell like resistors and stuff, like all the little electronic parts, not when they became a cell phone store. I don't know when that happened. But anyway, so, you know, Walmart opens up next door. Great. Walmart and Radio Shack sell a lot of the same products. You know, you can go to both places and get stereos and TVs and stuff. But there's that pretty significant set of products that only Radio Shack sells, because it's too small of a market for Walmart to care about, really. So Walmart will take away a lot of the benefits of that Radio Shack, but it'll take away a lot of the business of the Radio Shack, but the Radio Shack is always going to have a bunch of markets that only it corners because Walmart doesn't care. I think that's the exact same thing that's going to happen here with the App Store. I think, you know, the App Store is the Walmart, obviously, and you know, it's going to bring in huge amounts of customers to the area, to the Mac software environment. It's going to probably have pretty low average prices for a lot of the apps. What's popular there will be what's cheap, and it'll be kind of, you know, probably kind of fluffy single use apps.
Right.
And that's fine. And that's a whole new market that's being opened up for the most part. That market doesn't really exist in the Mac today because, you know, I've said this in a couple of places, the overhead involved in setting up payment and accepting payment from users and for the users to want to give payment doesn't really make sense for prices that are below maybe $8 today or $10 today.
Yeah.
So there's really no Mac software between free and $10. There's very, 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 very little of it. I think this is going to create that market. So there will be higher priced software there as well, certainly. But what's going to dominate the charts are going to be games, kind of, you know, mass market, kind of stupid apps like the stupid test, stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
Basically what dominates the iOS markets. That's going to dominate the charts. And those are all going to be pretty inexpensive, and a lot of geeks and Mac developers are going to look down on those for being simplistic or bad or whatever the case may be. But the fact is that's the market that's opening up. It's going to be something like that. And the entire rest of the Mac software market is still going to be able to operate.
Right. This doesn't really change that dynamic, I don't think, that significantly. Those other apps, whether it's Photoshop or Microsoft Office or SuperDuper, I think those continue to exist and operate the same way, unless, and I just don't think the App Store is going to be this disruptive. But I really don't think that people are going to think that this is the only way to get apps. They're going to know that they can still get them the traditional ways. Even some of the same apps that'll be in both places, they could still get the traditional way, right?
Oh, certainly. And especially because, as we said earlier, I think it's unlikely that we're ever going to see like Adobe products or Microsoft products on the App Store. And so there's always going to be these products that most people will need one of these things. You know, most people who buy a Mac buy Microsoft Office with it.
Yeah.
That's
you think
totally
even with iWork around now, they're still doing that?
I would imagine so, because a lot of people are very, very concerned with having perfect compatibility with their office or their school or whatever. So they buy it just because they don't really want to take any risks with that. And that's understandable. So there's always going to be software that most people know about that's not going to be in the App Store. So they're going to know to look elsewhere in addition to the App Store. But I think the App Store is going to be the place they look when they want to browse for something new, when they want to launch the app and waste some time knowing going into it that, okay, I'm about to go spend a few dollars on a new game or something.
Yeah.
Just to play around because I'm bored right now. That's going to be where the App Store shines. It's going to be in the kind of impulse buy, the browsing, the kind of lightweight, mostly games and entertainment apps. That's going to be huge. But the rest of the software market, that's most of today's market, is going to be fine. And a good portion of it will continue to exist outside of the App Store. And that's fine. And people will still find it.
So what's your advice then, as we probably should wrap up this show today? What's your advice for those people who are out there considering maybe is now a good time to start developing for macOS 10? What do you think?
So I think the answer is, if you're a game developer, especially if you're making a casual game, absolutely yes. By all means, get that into the App Store for the Mac. Any kind of casual gaming will do very, very, very well, I suspect. By the way, all this is totally speculation, obviously.
Yeah.
So don't hold me too hard to this. But I really think that it's going to be a massive goldmine for casual games. Very similar to iOS. And now, so for apps, it varies. A lot of apps are simple enough that they'll be able to make it in with no problems. They won't have any kind of private API needs. But people certainly use fewer apps. Now, that being said, there are a lot of categories of apps that there's effectively infinite demand for, as many as possible. One of those is any kind of to-do management app, a to-do list or task management, because everybody is a little bit unhappy with whatever is out there. And so, because everyone has different workflows and everyone has different preferences and how they like to enter things and how things should be organized and everything. So if you launch a to-do app, you are guaranteed a certain audience, because there's going to be enough people dissatisfied with everything else out there that they'll come to your app. And there's a few categories like that where there's effectively infinite demand for as many competitors as possible. Those will all do fine in the App Store. But I think overall, it's going to be mostly a casual game store.
Interesting.
Similar to iOS, really. I don't know if that's necessarily true by the numbers, but it's certainly true by the gross.
I was looking at a graph the other day. I think it was on the unofficial Apple weblog or a site similar to that, that was showing the number of games that are out there for iOS are greater than the number of games for pretty much all of the console devices that have ever been made all together.
Oh,
now,
sure.
I mean, obviously, it requires much, much, much less to get a game onto an iOS device from the standpoint of resources. I mean, it's just a file, so it's maybe an unfair comparison, but it certainly demonstrates how effective iOS devices are, and I suppose Android too, but mobile phones in general, those devices are in creating a platform for casual gaming. Do you think though that the casual gaming is going to be as big on a computer as it is on a device that you've got in your pocket? Do you think it'll really be the same?
Well, it'll be a different market. It'll be an older market for one. A lot of the gaming market for iOS is young iPod Touch users. But I think, you know, look at the market now for casual Flash games online. It's huge. Because it's basically everyone who owns a computer.
Yeah.
And I think that's the market that this is going to cut into, is like the casual online Flash game for computers.
Yeah.
This is going to really cut into that and take advantage of that huge market. Because, I mean, that market is bigger than any geek ever estimates. Trust me, it's ridiculous how big that market is. And, you know, I heard some said a long time ago, I don't know if this is actually true today or not, but this was like 10 years ago, I was reading something, and it said that the number one selling games at retail, like in you know, Walmart, Best Buy, the best selling games at retail are things like those Mahjong collections. It's all like the games that like that your non-technical older relatives will buy, right, to goof around with on their crappy PC that doesn't even have a 3D card. It's those outgross like every major high-end 3D game. Now, wow. I don't know if that's true today, but that was true a few years ago at least. And so I think that really tells you something. It tells you the relative size of these markets. Because think about it, like the 3D gaming market, like the high-end gaming market, requires hardware that most computers don't have. Most computers are laptops these days, for one, that people are actually buying for themselves.
Right.
And most computers don't have any reasonable 3D capabilities at all. Even most Macs don't, really. I mean, the low-end ones with the NVIDIA built-in chips are okay.
Right.
Certainly a huge step up from the GMA950, but it's still, you know, if you're playing high-end games on a computer instead of a console, you probably have a PC desktop that you built yourself. Whereas, and everyone else who's buying games at Walmart and stuff, they're buying those Mahjong collections that'll run on Windows 3.1 or greater.
Right.
You know, and that's the market. It's casual. That's why the Wii does so well. Because the Wii goes for that casual gaming market, not the hardcore 3D people. It's going for the people who don't necessarily even consider themselves video game players, but they, you know, they want something a little bit past solitaire on their computer.
Right.
And so if you can attack that market, I mean, that's why iOS has done so well with gaming, because a lot of people buy iPhones who don't own any game consoles or who don't consider themselves gamers, but they want a phone. So they buy the iPhone or they buy an iPod Touch because they want an iPod. And then they have this device that happens to be able to play games pretty well as well. So, I want to waste some time sometime. Oh, how about this Solitaire Plus? You know,
yeah.
And that, I mean, that's just a massive market.
Great advice. Well, hey, man, we kind of hit the wall here. We've almost an hour in, so we've got to wrap this thing up. But we'll be back next week. Thanks to everybody for tuning in and for listening. We always appreciate it. We appreciate the ratings in iTunes. Really, just so much fun to do this show with you. So thanks for doing that. Marco, you can check more. Where can people follow you, Marco, if they want to?
Just go to Marco.org.
Marco.org, easiest way. And Marco, yep. Arment on Twitter. I'm Dan Benjamin on Twitter. And thanks to SensibleWorld.net for sponsoring the show. And we will see you all again here next week.